passion, drive, and patience. What brings home the winning trophy is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. From superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED lights, and more, whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to turn your car into the MVP and bring home that win. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates, plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
Hello and welcome to Pollock and Thurston. It is Wednesday, March the 27th. This is the penultimate Pollock and Thurston before WrestleMania. How are you, Brandon?
It's good to be here on the penultimate version of this program. I'm good. How are you?
It is penultimate week, and we are going to have quite the show for everyone coming up. Not one, but two guests that are going to be stopping by.
More lawyers.
That's what people come here for. I mean, obviously, just out there for all the clicks that we are after. But we are going to be joined by lawyer himself, CJ Donald, who you may have heard on WrestleNomics a number of months back. Maybe one personality that might get me to join TikTok. He has quite the TikTok channel, yes. But not quite. I'm not going to join TikTok over that. But also joining us will be author Brad Baluchian, who is the author of this new book that is out, I believe, next week, The Six Pack. And there's a really intriguing chapter. Well, the book is intriguing, but in particular, we're going to be focusing on this chapter about the national expansion of the WWF and some really interesting facts and people that Brad Baluchian unearthed in terms of the development of Titan Sports and its expansion during the mid-80s. So two guests coming at you today on Pollock and Thurston, and we will be discussing, off the top, a report that Brandon and I released on Tuesday regarding the now public WWE consensual relationship policy that went into effect in June of last year. Brandon and I were able to obtain the policy and also spoke to a number of experts in the field to get their kind of third party reaction to the policy and kind of just going through. Obviously, this was in response to the scandal involving Vince McMahon and having something concrete on paper as it regards consensual relationships within the company. And I guess taking yourself away, Brandon, that we've kind of been hyper-focused on this the story over the last week. What do you think is like the big takeaway from this policy and how you understand it?
Well, it exists. And I know one thing we can say about this is that it existed. It was established in June 2023, which is about 1 year after the first Wall Street Journal report about Vince McMahon's various NDAs. I understand. I mean, according to Professor Lisa Maniero, who we have quotes in this article from, only 30% of companies even have policies like this. You can understand why WWE established one. The language isn't super specific, but it does say that, you know, anybody can be fired for violating this policy.
Yeah. I mean, some of the key wording, and I do encourage everyone to read our articles, whether on the WrestleNomics site or on Post Wrestling, it's on both. Is the fact that you know, they strongly discourage employees engaging in relationships with anyone, with board members, an executive team member, outlining the CEO, president, CFO, chief content officer, chief legal officer, or chief human resources officer. And Also stating consensual relationships are prohibited when effective arrangements to address the conflict cannot be made. So all of these could be subject to termination, but it does leave some kind of interpretation of some of the language of whether this is strictly prohibited or if there are certain case-by-case instances that they would adjudicate.
Yes, effective arrangements feels like there's a lot of wiggle room there. Another thing we could add here, too, is that I'm not sure how much awareness there is within WWE broadly about this policy. We asked, one thing we tried to establish is make sure that there was no policy before this that we were aware of, that employees were aware of. So we asked various employees, current and former. Nobody was aware of a policy like this before it, June 2023. And we've heard comments from Shawn Michaels on NXT media call on February 1st. And he said that he referred to the policy changes happening in 2022. I assume he was just going back further than this policy was actually established. And he said he had not memorized it. He could not tell you the exact details of it. Paul Levesque had a very general answer, at the Royal Rumble press conference about what kind of policies are in place to make sure that people, to make sure that, you know, executives and supervisors are not exploiting the people underneath them. So not sure how much, you know, awareness there really is, or, you know, I think it's notable that Paul Levesque and Shawn Michaels could not articulate what the differences were.
So we're going to discuss the policy a bit further when CJ joins us in a couple of minutes, but off the top, I wanted to hit a couple of subjects, including AEW's announcement of Double or Nothing, which will be going back to Las Vegas and back to the MGM Grand Garden Arena, which staged the first Double or Nothing in 2019, which was also the company's first show ever prior to them getting onto television. The last 2 years, they had run at the somewhat larger T-Mobile Arena in Las Vegas. And also part of this announcement is back-to-back nights with Collision followed by the pay-per-view. And Double or Nothing, as things are scheduled now, would be going head-to-head with the NXT Battleground show. So we do have Memorial Day weekend is the Battleground.
Yes. And what's is NXT on the Saturday or the Sunday? What did you just say?
The Sunday.
So yes. A pay-per-view head-to-head with a PLE. We've seen PLEs go head-to-head. I had not even realized this. We've seen PLEs go head-to-head with Collision. And even the NXT PLEs have shown to do damage to the Collision rating. When it comes to a pay-per-view, I would think you're dealing with a smaller audience because there's a $50 paywall in the way. So it's going to be a harder core of people. But maybe that will have an effect on the pay-per-view. Lord knows what kind of numbers we'll get. We'll get some sort of comment from Tony Khan, maybe some reports later about what those pay-per-view numbers are. But I would think it would have some minor impact at least.
Yeah. And will wrestling fans, will they be watching Double the Wrestling or Nothing? That's the question that night.
That is the question. That is the headline.
In terms of the venue that they are running, I mean, it's not smaller. It is a smaller one. And what did we see last year? How did they perform at the T-Mobile Arena in Las Vegas last year?
I have the numbers somewhere here. So in 2022, so 2 years before this show, 13,000 tickets distributed, and then last year's show, 10,500. And the T-Mobile Arena, I mean, 10,000 attendance crowd is a nice crowd. But T-Mobile Arena, there were some empty seats there. I was there personally. I remember looking around and sort of noticing where the empty seats were. But yeah, this will be a smaller venue that they can fill more of the percentage of the venue for, and it seems more appropriate. I understand that the T-Mobile Arena is more expensive to run than MGM too, so that's probably a contributing factor here.
Yeah, and everyone will remember the 2 years ago, Double or Nothing being the event that Hangman Page jeopardized $1 million house for, which was the lead up to that particular event in 2022. Worth noting is Monday's performance for Raw. I thought this was a very, very interesting number because this was a talk heavy edition of Raw, and Brandon's quarter hours that you can always find at WrestleNomics the day after. It did show an interesting pattern here in that they had advertised this show around CM Punk appearing in Chicago, and they put him out there for close to 25 minutes. And this was the giant winner of the night with 2.2 million viewers. This was an 18% spike in viewership from the previous quarter. And if you look earlier, we got an unadvertised appearance by The Rock in the opening quarter. And I mean, you can certainly debate from a fan's perspective. I think they love surprises such as The Rock showing up unannounced. But you can also see the value in having a big ace up your sleeve and promoting it. And in this case, I think everyone was here for the Punk segment and putting it at that crossover into the second hour, which seems to be the main event segment of the show most weeks.
I had not realized that the Rock appearance was an unadvertised appearance. That this was what in this run for the Rock in WWE, his sixth something like that appearance on WTV. I've lost count. The point I'm getting to is, I guess I'm questioning how much it really would have helped. Could have helped some, but did it really help a ton? I don't know. Both of these, the first quarter hour and the Punk, Drew McIntyre, Seth Rollins quarter hour, no ad breaks, which is a big advantage. But nonetheless, this I'll show the line chart. This bump for that Punk Rollins Drew McIntyre segment. Yes, it had no ad breaks. Yes, it was in the 9 o'clock crossover segment into the second hour, which is often a strong quarter hour. Nonetheless, this is a huge increase relative to everything around it. Helps to have Punk in a return segment, right? He hadn't been on TV in weeks. The Rock, you know, by contrast, is the biggest star in Hollywood, perhaps, but he's been around for a while. He's not as novel. But this clearly, I mean, you have to attribute this to the content, I think.
Did you see the segment involving CM Punk, Drew McIntyre, and Seth Rollins?
I saw it live, yes. I actually watched it with my own eyes on television, on the USA Network. I thought it's a tremendous bit of irony that the two words, you know, we've heard people say the words wrestling more often. There seems to be less of a control on the language, even especially in this segment. There's less scripting and less control on this segment. But the two words you shall not dare utter on W television, Vince McMahon.
No, but they would, CM Punk got the closest to tiptoeing around those words on.
Say his name. Midnight. Say it.
That's it. I mean, yes. The cutaway to Drew McIntyre when, I mean, that reaction, like he was like, I have been definitely cornered on this particular one and, yes. And how you come back on that one. So
there may have been a disturbance in my house from me shouting some expletives when that moment happened.
So yeah, it was a really big segment and this was going against that giant Iowa West Virginia women's yes. college game. It did 4.9 million viewers on ESPN. So this was, as I read the stats, the third largest women's tournament game in the past 20 years and the largest outside of the Final Four. So this was not a case of WWE having just a routine night of competition. This was a look at this. This peaked at 6.4 million viewers. Huge game that they were up against. And Raw was up from the week prior. And in particular, I mean, it's almost like when you have strong programming and you have that wave of momentum behind you. Look at that. You can hold up really well even against fierce competition.
Yeah. And who's the big star on Iowa's team? Do you know?
This is Caitlin Clark. Yes,
Caitlin Clark. Caitlin Clark, a proven draw. I was looking at the ranking that Raw has put up the last several weeks. And I think since NFL ended, it's been number one on cable consecutively until this past Monday when it was outranked by Caitlin Clark, who is clearly a draw. Big questions around who she's going to put over. She's going on to the WNBA after this season, so she's got to put somebody over and try to elevate some stars. We'll see what happens. I know that people are looking for an LSU versus Iowa tournament final. We'll see.
The final boss, Caitlin Clark. Well, big numbers for Raw as they go into the ultimate week before WrestleMania next week. Before we welcome in our guests, we need a ruling, okay? There is two massive entities that are at odds, the WWE, the all-powerful, and the all-powerful WrestleTix.
Oh, yes.
Now, when it comes to last Monday, Raleigh, North Carolina, the PNC Arena, reportedly just under 200 tickets shy of a sellout. WWE has gone forward. They have now created graphics on Raw to promote their consecutive television sellout streak. Where do we stand on last Monday's Raw in the sellout streak? I mean, technically not a sellout. How are we to move forward, Brandon? Has the streak ended
for WrestleTix on this past Monday?
No, a week ago Monday.
A week ago Monday. Raleigh, 12,682 is the number that WrestleTix has for the PNC Arena. What's the capacity of that building?
I think the setup was, I think what WrestleTix had stated was that they were 200 shy of a sellout. Now, typically, that is considered a sellout. Like when the UFC was doing their whole streak and stuff like that, like there were plenty of examples of like 98% capacity or whatever. So anyway, this is a ruling for the ticketing arbiters out there to weigh in on.
So if we at 200 shy of a sellout, if we say that is 98%, that's 98.4%. So if 99% is your threshold, it does fall short of that by about 0.5%.
Okay. Well, there you have it. I'm not going to argue with math.
But you can't dismiss the fact. I mean, I tweeted a table earlier today. Year over year, attendance is up. In the demo, ratings are up. Their business is still continuing to show good year-over-year comparisons and a lot better than 2022 when, you know, it was probably just people being afraid of going to shows after COVID probably, right? That's all that was the difference that you can really point out there.
Well, at this point, it's time to welcome in our first guest of the show. He is an attorney that is dropping by to give us all of his knowledge, all of his insight. CJ Donald here on the program. CJ, thank you so much for taking some time to chat with us today.
Hi, CJ.
Thanks for how you doing, John, Brandon. How are y'all? And thank you for having me on today. I appreciate it.
So, I mean, we have been going through this Janelle Grant lawsuit ever since it was filed back in January. I'm kind of curious just some of your overall thoughts on the process of what has come out, what we have learned over time, and where things kind of stand in this case from your vantage point. Like, what are the big questions on your mind?
Yeah, so maybe I'll start with that last question first. So things stand right now this way. Janelle Grant has the ability, if she wants to amend her initial complaint, the pleading. She has, I think, until the end of this week to do that. The date on Pacer, which is the online web page where you get all these documents from, says the 25th, but I think they've extended that a few days. And what happens is after she amends that, or if she doesn't amend that, then WWE, Vince McMahon, and John Laurinaitis will get the chance to respond. They'll answer. Their answer is going to be due in May, most likely. I saw a date earlier today, said May 14th for John Laurinaitis' answer.
Yeah, so Laurinaitis has been given a waiver of service. He was given that on the 20th, 7 days ago, and his answer due is May 14th. But apparently WWE and Vince McMahon have not been given a waiver of service yet.
So that was something I was going to bring up. It's a little bit weird that they haven't answered with the waiver of service and signed it. It's a very simple process, just to explain for folks at home. What happens in a federal case is that usually you know the players and you know their lawyers. And so you serve them electronically and you give them a document that's called waiver of summons or waiver of service. And pretty much they say, you know, you don't have to find the person to physically hand this to me. I'm going to accept, you know, service via email. I'm going to send you back this document that says, hey, I've accepted that. The benefit for you as the defendant is that you get a longer time to answer a complaint. So usually it's 21 days from receiving, the service of process. But you see here, Brandon's helpfully put it up for us. It's 60 days from the time that Johnny sent it back in. So you have that. So that's where we stand, is that we're looking for the next thing to happen is either an amended pleading from Janelle, which I said was due earlier this week, or the next thing is the answer. My overall impressions of this, though, obviously this is a very, very serious matter. Mm-hmm. Is that it seems like the WWE did not really do anything from the time that the initial Wall Street Journal article came out until the time the lawsuit dropped. And that was kind of shocking. I don't know if
talking about initially in June 2022, you mean?
Exactly right. Exactly right. And that was shocking to me because we know this thing. Big company, you know, they have professional people working in the background. And so I'd be curious to know whether kind of the lack of, you know, external action there was something that was a strategy, right, to downplay these allegations, to try to make it all go away. Or was it something that due to there being changes in the board, due to, you know, as you all have discussed many times, right, Vince leaving and then coming back, and whether it was kind of an intentional thing that was done kind of sloppy. Right. So I think we should take a step back and really ask WWE, why hasn't there been a bigger response? you know, Brandon, I saw that you asked, you know, Triple H at one of the press conferences, you know, what are you all doing to make sure this doesn't happen again? And the response, right, was everything. But I mean, is it really everything if we've waited, you know, nearly 2 years to get a response from you all on even changing, you know, the policy externally, which we didn't know until you all wrote this great article?
And by a response, you mean an establishment of a policy? Because we've reported, as we opened at the beginning, we've reported that there is a policy, but it is dated June 2023, which is 1 year after. I guess we should say here, you know, we did ask WWE about specifically about, you know, I anticipate readers are going to wonder why there was a year span between the first Wall Street Journal article in June 2022 and June 2023, but they didn't want to give us a comment about that. But that is a question that we asked.
Right. Well, and they know that people are focused on this issue, right? So why has it taken until you all using your sources and doing the digging to uncover this? Why wasn't this offered up to the public as, hey, look, we are trying to modernize our company? I think that's just a big oversight and maybe an overplay of their hand in how they think they're perceived by the general public.
What's your understanding, CJ? Because one thing that we constantly come back to is if we just take it at face value that the only knowledge that some of the officers had and people in the company in positions of power was that Vince McMahon had a relationship with this employee. They were not aware of the abuse, some of the darker details, just on its face, the relationship. Is that something that should immediately have been taken to HR? Like, what is the proper protocol? If anything, like, is there a gray area of acceptance when it comes to such a power disparity and that a relationship is somewhat an open secret in the company?
That is an interesting question. And I think that's one on which reasonable minds can disagree, right? Set the abuse aside. We're not talking about that. That is despicable, right? Disgusting, right? But if we just say that, you know, the person who's the chair of the board is having relations with someone who works for him, right? That is not illegal. And unless there's actually company policy, which, as we just discussed, there was not, right, until 23. Like, he hasn't done anything, quote unquote, wrong. The issue I have with people kind of jumping on and saying, well, this was, like, from the outset, just, like, terrible that they even had any relationship at all, is that from a shareholder standpoint, right, the question is whether the executives who knew about this relationship felt the relationship would either negatively impact the company or result in financial harm to the company, right? So negatively impact the reputation or whatever, standing in the community, or actually hurt the stock price. The execs and the board members have a legal duty to protect the company's bottom line. And in my experience, when we see executive misconduct, it's usually like uncovered in connection with poor financial results or criminal charges, right? So here it's kind of like backwards. We've learned about this thing that seemed to be bad, and then we heard about the actual abuse. And the problem for anybody that's worried about what the execs were doing or whether they use good judgment here is that the company is more valuable than ever, right? The TKO is trading down slightly, I think, in the last few days, but all the investment banking analysts are either issuing buy or hold ratings on the company. So it's kind of hard to show that this has tarnished the company's value, despite how absolutely disgusting, right, the alleged behavior is.
I guess as well, when you look at sort of there's the knowledge of the relationship and then comes the promotion that she receives. It's about a year into her time in the company, and they wanted to leapfrog her to a VP role. And somebody there said, listen, that's too much of a jump for us. Let's settle here at a director level with the promise of a VP role to come. Then we're getting into company funds. And was this a promotion that was based on merit or simply off this relationship? And then I guess we're getting into more troubled territory when it comes to company funds and how they're being allocated to someone with a relationship to Vince McMahon.
That's exactly right. You mean the board has a fiduciary duty to make sure the company isn't wasting its money, right? And so I think if someone could prove, a shareholder could prove, hey, this was a waste of money, it's minor, right, in the grand scheme of this large company. But I think that is a good point that we should keep our eye on.
If you are Vince McMahon right now, what is, not asking you to get into his head, but sort of what are the immediate priorities in terms of mounting a legal defense to this? I mean, he is obviously, other than saying he would vigorously defend himself, he's kept very quiet in this time period. What do you sense from a legal standpoint? Is what ducks are he is he getting in a row at the moment?
Okay. So the big question for Vince and WWE is whether or not they're going to have a joint defense here or not. The joint defense obviously allows them to not only share like information, but they actually can share legal counsel if they desire to do that. I think, you know, obviously the WWE can hire whoever they want as counsel. I think Simpson Thatcher Bartlett, which one of the best firms in the country, did their internal investigation back in 22 about this initial NDA issue with Janelle Grant. But that's his first question is WWE going to support Vince in this lawsuit? Are they going to go at it separately? That's the first question. The second question I think that we need to know more about, and we're not going to know more about just because this is not how these things work, is whether or not WWE is doing an actual internal investigation, right? And so we heard about, I just mentioned this internal investigation that was done around the NDAs and the hush money payments and all that, right?
But there's it was said to be about company culture too.
Exactly right, company culture. So I really want to know, like, who else knew about this besides just the executives that we know? The other, you know, coworkers of Janelle Grant's know about this. Were there people that, you know, talent, they know about this, right? We need to really, I think, understand not just the people that we know, but people that we don't know. And what did they actually know about this incident? We're not going to know that. The key here is that if they do an internal investigation and they're doing it in conjunction with this lawsuit, that all that stuff is attorney-client privilege, right? So then, you know, Vince can be better prepared about, you know, what's going to come out at trial. What do people actually know about me? What might they testify about me at the trial if there's a proper investigation done? Because the last thing I think he would want or the company would want is to not do this investigation or overlook someone, right, in the interview process. And then maybe Janelle Grant's lawyers called them. Maybe the feds called them, right? And then they all of a sudden have new information or other evidence. I think Vince should also really be worried about the federal investigation and doing all he can to cooperate with that. That actually is probably more important in the long run than the civil lawsuit. As you all know, the sex trafficking has a minimum of 10 years, and it's 15-year minimum if it's by forced fraud or coercion. So what is he concerned about? First, it's can he defend himself with the company or is it going to go at it solo? Secondly, find out who can be on your side, who knows bad facts about you so you can mitigate those. And then third is figure out how to work with the feds to not have to go to jail.
And do you agree with like what I have the impression is just the conventional wisdom that if there's a grand jury investigation and I guess we don't know if Vince is the center of it, if he's the subject, but it's almost always the case, is it not, that grand juries indict?
I don't know the exact numbers, but it's a pretty high percentage on the federal level. And that's just because the federal government doesn't have time to bring cases that are not meritorious.
And in the event that we were to get an indictment, I mean, would the civil case and the federal investigation just kind of move in parallel paths? Would there be some kind of coordination in any kind of, like, can you paint any kind of picture for us on how that would look like? If like Janelle Grant, you would think would be working with the federal government at that point as a key witness.
Yep. Definitely would be a key witness for the federal government. You know, the federal government might let the civil case proceed first, right? And then see, you know, what mistakes her counsel makes. What testimony can they get drawn out and then come back and follow it with an indictment later, right? Or charging papers later. The other thing to keep an eye on is that discovery is scheduled to, I think, conclude by what is it, the end of this year on this civil matter. So maybe instead of waiting until trial, maybe the federal, you know, investigation waits until they can see the discovery, right? And which they can if Janelle Grant brings them in. I think there's an issue there probably on the confidentiality piece about what can be shared and what can be made public, but we don't have to go into that today.
Yeah. And in that case, if we're talking about waiting to discovery till this Grant case gets to that point, that's a long way away after, yeah, if an indictment were to occur, yep, it occurring would be, yep, even further into the future, not anytime, yeah, soon.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Yeah. Yeah.
And do you make anything of, we were talking about the waiver of service and that Laura Nice has been served, but WWE and Vince have not. Does that tell you anything about, I guess, do you think that's related to the fact that Laurinaitis has seemed to have flipped on Vince and says he's a victim too? Is he maybe cooperating with the plaintiff more so than WWE and Vince are? Do you make anything of that?
I don't make anything of it yet, right? So we mentioned that Johnny signed this thing. He just did it this week, right? So if we go another month or two and there's no answer from Vince or the company, and there's also no waiver of service from the company, then I think they're playing games with the plaintiff, right? But at this point, I think it's too early to tell really what they're doing there.
And could any of those cards be held in the plaintiff's hands? Like, do they have to do something to serve them, right?
That's right. You have to find them. So WWE is easy to serve, right? You just go to their building, you serve a corporate officer. You know, Vince, you have to serve him in person or go to his residence, and you have to, you know, serve either him personally or an adult that is there at the time. Okay. So,
go ahead.
No, that was it.
Okay. So, and another thing I think a lot of people are thinking about in this, especially in this day and age and post Me Too, and is it even, you know, what's the sort of consensus, or to what degree is there one about, can it even be a consensual relationship when you're, say, the CEO of a company that's worth billions of dollars, got 800 plus employees in your company? Is it even right to say that you could have a consensual relationship with somebody who's a lower level employee like Janelle Grant was?
Yeah. So I read the article you all published today, and I really think that it is possible, but not in this situation. I think it's only really possible where the employees are similar rank or same rank, and then one ends up surpassing the other, you know, later, right? Mm-hmm. This obviously is, you know, a person owns a company, then decides to bring in someone at a lower level. Like, that is a totally different type of situation. Whether or not this was consensual, I think we have to really dig deeper and get Vince's facts as well as we know from the plaintiff. But I think it is possible. I think we've seen it a lot in business, a lot in higher education, especially, right? You see teachers all the time who end up marrying students. That's a common thing. But I think the bigger issue here with WWE is not whether this was consensual early. It's that they didn't have a policy at all or any kind of practice to report, you know, abuse or harassment or any kind of misconduct, right? Like, it seems like there was nobody there who was saying, if you have any issues, come to me. And that's something that, you know, modern companies really do well, is they have ethics hotlines and whistleblower hotlines that are set up.
Yeah, and to be clear, WWE does have a code of conduct and did have various versions of a code of conduct. They did not have at least a specific policy, and I would have to, about consensual relationships, and I have to go back and look to see what those prior editions of the code of conduct said about whether there was any outlet for reporting ethics violations. Like, there is at least now in this current consensual relationship policy.
Right. Exactly. Right.
What do you make of the consensual relationship policy, if you've had a chance to go through any of it, and does it stand out to you as like a, does it look like a standard policy to you? Do you see any holes in it? I mean, how do you assess the status of their policy that is, you know, roughly 9 months old?
Yeah. I mean, it felt like, you know, we're at Rumble 24 before CM Punk came out. It just felt like, okay. You know, he was okay. You know, it wasn't bad. It wasn't good. It was okay. I noticed that the law professor from Texas A&M mentioned that the policy should actually provide for immediate termination of an executive who engaged in a relationship with a subordinate. I think that's too far, because as I mentioned, there's an ability there to actually have consensual relationships in the workplace, especially when you're working as much as these people work. But I do think that their policy is a little bit light, right? One of the things we often see is that you can report, of course, like you say, here to the hotline, through a secure website or through a phone number. But there's usually more than one person that is, you know, the quote unquote compliance champion, the ethics champion, right? I've seen numbers suggested for a company this size to be 5 or 10 people, right? Because you want to get folks in different departments, different age ranges, different groups, different genders, so that people feel comfortable reporting issues, right?
The other thing redacted here is there's a website, and we didn't want to put the website out there, so people went and, you know, sent spam messages there. But it is a third party website. I didn't call the phone number, so I don't know what that leads to, but I assume it's something third party.
Yeah, and that makes sense. That makes sense, and that is industry standard. But, you know, I think what you'd want even more than that is somebody actually in the company who really is connected with other employees, and people feel safe, you know, confiding it.
A point I constantly look at as well, and this is more of a philosophical discussion, and that is having one entity, in this case, Vince McMahon, that is so isolated from any checks or balances that, yes, we can have all the policies in the world and we can have all of these different departments, but if this guy has these super shares that he can steamroll himself back onto a board of directors, that only is going to put other officers into an ability to turn the other eye, because I'm not putting my own job at stake. And just having that much of a disparity in power. I mean, here we're seeing one of the worst case scenarios of what happens there and what can be happening that no one is aware of, allegedly.
That's right. It means unchecked power, right? He built the company essentially. And so people probably feel a lot of loyalty to him. They're also probably scared for their jobs. I will say that, you know, EEOC has lots of literature about this. If you report an incident of harassment or any kind of abuse at work, that is protected by the federal government. And if you get any kind of retaliation, whether it's a demotion, you miss a bonus, you miss a check, you miss a work opportunity, you get fired, you can then sue the company for that. The problem just is that usually people aren't savvy enough to go through that process or willing to go through that process.
Sure.
So to John, to your point, I do think that when we have kind of these, you know, kind of mega owners, person with a super share that can do whatever they want, these issues are more pronounced. And we see that in all kinds of companies.
And just to add, since the TKO merger, Vince no longer has the super shares. He does have something like, I think now after his sales, 9% of the stock, but only 9% of the vote, as opposed to when he had 36% of the shares and 80% of the vote because of those 10X shares that he had. So it will be a lot harder to imagine how he would force himself back into the company at this point.
Exactly.
I'm as well curious, CJ, just like following the product as you do, are you surprised? Like, it almost feels like we're talking about like this duality of WWE, that here is this horrendous lawsuit and these terrible details that come to light. And yet, if you're just watching the on-screen product, they are on fire at the moment and not slowing down. It seems as though any concern about this impacting business, it's only been the opposite.
Yeah, I think it's because it's still early, right, in the lawsuit and in federal investigation. You've seen online maybe pushing back a little bit on, hey, you all should really be thinking more about these other issues deeply, not just praising the product. But you're right, the gate receipts haven't slowed down. I think if we get to a trial in this case, and there gets to be even more facts put out, people will push back a little bit. But, you know, frankly, this is how America is, right? Our sports are supreme. And when people do bad things, especially our sports heroes, we try to forgive them. We try to, you know, get back on board with them, and we support the product. There's also, I think that is probably not wise, and it's not good that we do that, but that's part of our culture, right? There's also the people that think, well, the talent is different than Vince, and so I'm supporting the talent, right, and not the person that is the billionaire. You know, we can have a further conversation about that, but I think that a lot of people feel that way as well.
Yeah, I think there's two things at least happening in that. Vince being out of control of creative has allowed the creative to improve in a way that has increased fan engagement, including ticket sales and TV ratings. That has happened. Plus, I think a surface level reading of this story, which, you know, for better or worse, is about as deeply as most people are going to go, is that this is a Vince thing, and Vince is out. And that's what else is there to the story? They're not really sure, probably, and are not aware of the fact that, yes, WWE is being sued as well as Vince McMahon and John Laurinaitis.
Right. And not only sued, right, but is responsible for letting this happen. The board members are responsible for letting this happen, whether they get, you know, called to the carpet for that or not, whether shareholders get upset about that or not, you know, it remains to be seen. But I do believe, right, just a reasonable person, I believe that somebody besides John Laurinaitis knew this was happening, right?
And to be clear, Janelle Grant alleges that four officers who have not been reported as Nick Conn, Brad Blum, Stephanie McMahon, and Brian Nurse, who's the general counsel, they all allegedly, according to her, knew.
Right.
About the relationship, not necessarily about abuse.
Right. And I don't have any opinion on whether those four people actually knew. Right. But I know I just kind of feel based on how this worked that more than just four people knew about this relationship and maybe also the abuse.
CJ, this has been great just to get all of your insight into this case that we've been following. I know you have a prolific TikTok channel. Is there anything you would like to throw out there for people to catch more of your work and analysis out there?
No, thanks very much for having me on and look forward to seeing what you all do and following this going forward.
Awesome. Thanks very much, CJ. We'll talk soon. Thank you.
Thanks, CJ.
Have a good day.
All right. CJ Donald, everyone, joining us. Some great points brought up there in the whole Janelle Grant suit. And again, if you want to look at our article on the WWE's consensual relationship policy, it is up at postwrestling.com and wrestlenomics.com. But the guests don't stop. Next up, joining us, he is the author of the brand new book, The Six Pack, which is out next week through Hatchet Books. Joining us now, Brad Baluchian, who is here with us. Brad, congratulations on the book, and thanks so much for stopping by to chat with us today.
Hi, Brad. You said my name so well, John. I love it.
It's not too many sites that have it frenetically out there for everybody, but no, I did my due diligence.
First book, I learned my lesson of, you know, put a pronunciation guide in there.
Well, as someone that has had my name butchered throughout most of my life, I definitely sympathize. This was interesting just in the sense of what this book began as, what it evolved into, and then the finished product. And it sort of was bookended by the late Khosrow Vaziri, a.k.a. the Iron Sheik. And it kind of took you on this path of starting as one thing and turning into what was kind of like a miniature history of the entire company.
Yeah, no, I started out in 2005. I had left my job at Islands Magazine to go work with Khosrow Vaziri to write a book about him and, you know, write an Iron Sheik biography. And the guy, I mean, he has enough stories to fill three biographies. And as the first line of the book says, the Iron Sheik just threatened to kill me. That, you know, that sets the stage for how not ready he was at that time to work on something like this. And he was my favorite wrestler as a kid. So I had this very personal interest or stake in telling his story, got to know him personally. You know, he was in a pretty dark place at that point and sort of went on with my life, excuse me. And then a few years ago, after my first book came out about tracking down former baseball players, I said, man, I think there's an opportunity to revisit that story. And so what I did is I set out to drive 12,525 miles plus went to Puerto Rico to find six of the guys that were on the show when the Iron Sheik became the champion in Madison Square Garden in 1983 and to track those guys down. Puerto Rico was for Jose Luis Rivera. That's why I went over there. And also Hulk Hogan and Vince McMahon as people that I wanted to track down. And so it's the story of that road trip. And I think more broadly, it's the story of the WWF expansion in 83, 84. And it's really the story of to what extent did each of these guys I wrote about become their characters or not? And, you know, kind of the playing with the myth versus reality theme that is inherent to wrestling.
And in terms of the research that you did into Vince McMahon, I mean, there is a lot of that myth versus reality, especially in the early years of Vince McMahon, his upbringing. Can you tell us a little bit about what you discovered about Vince McMahon and sort of the years prior to him taking over his father's company?
Yeah, well, Josie Reisman, in her biography last year of Vince, did a really good job of going on the ground mm-hmm. in North Carolina to tell some, you know, she broke new ground about Vince's upbringing and childhood. And, you know, some of that had come out in the Playboy interview from 2001. So we all knew that Vince had a pretty traumatic childhood involving abuse from his stepfather and even his mother, it appears. But where I was able to break new ground was from basically 1979 to 84, where Vince is now... He didn't, contrary to the common narrative, he didn't own the Cape Cod Coliseum. He and Linda leased the Cape Cod Coliseum out there in Massachusetts. They were living in South Yarmouth, and they were running the building. and he buys the company in 1982 from his dad. And I was able to track down Jim Troy, who was the senior vice president of Titan Sports at that point, who Vince met through being a hockey player on the team that played the Cape Cod Buccaneers in the Cape Cod Coliseum. Oh, there he is. There's Jim. Jim was sort of Vince's right-hand man, and he's the guy who went around the country with Joe Perkins asking TV stations to air WWF instead of their local territory. So being able to track down Jim Troy and Ed Ricciuti, who was one of the first editors of WWF magazine, Ed Halinski, who actually started the first magazine, Victory Magazine, in 1983 when he was poached along with Steve Taylor, the photographer, from a newspaper in New York. And to hear how this, the brilliant Trojan horse strategy of how, you know, Vince had this new magazine and he would have Ed and Steve call up promoters and say, hey, we want to do a story on your territory. We're going to send a guy down. And so, you know, Ed or Steve would go get on a plane and go to down to Dallas or Minnesota and cover the show. And in the meantime, hand out Vince's business card and to give to the talent to say, hey, give me a call, because Vince was trying to poach everybody. You know, that's how he got Terry Bollea, how he got Hogan in late 83, was through a transaction like that. And then Bob McMullen, who was the CFO of the WWF starting in 1983, you know, he's one of the only people that would know. And he was able to tell me how they managed the finances, how they opened a line of credit, how much Hulk got paid for WrestleMania I, whether it's true or not that Vince really did mortgage everything in WrestleMania I. I mean, these are things that have been told on how many documentaries, but have never, the people that I spoke to really had never gone on the record before. So I was able to really do some good reporting and fact checking around that particular time period.
Yeah. And from like my perspective of covering the business now, it was really interesting to read that chapter of your book and think about how the business was then in terms of putting together TV deals. It's like Jim Troy was, you know, basically the person who was going around and making all these TV deals, whether it was with USA Network or other networks, right?
Yeah. And there's, you know, there's been that story, excuse me, about how WWF got on the USA Network. And, you know, they had All American Wrestling was the first show before even primetime wrestling. And Jim was able to tell me how he helped put together the meeting with Kay Koplowitz from USA, that they were showing Southwest Championship Wrestling at the time, and how they were able to negotiate. You know, they're basically saying, hey, we're kid friendly, we're family friendly. You don't want that garbage that has, you know, because there was an angle where someone dumped pig feces on someone else in Southwest Championship Wrestling. And, you know, Vince is saying, hey, we're this, you know, family friendly company. And then, you know, Vince was all about the presentation, right? Like he made everybody wear dress shirts and suits. And, you know, it was like getting them to adjust to this mindset of presenting this professional look all the time.
I thought that Bob McMullen was one of the most fascinating figures in this, and him being someone that it seemed like coming into the company, just bringing it up to standards to the point that you had these road agents that are going around the country with briefcases of cash for weeks on end. Like, this is an all cash company. And it's just like something out of the 40s that they're operating from. And I just thought Bob McMullen, like, what a great find in terms of just being able to dispel some of the myths and give you insight that not too many are going to have from that period.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, there's this narrative in society in wrestling that like Vince, you know, was this genius that built in, and he definitely was a ambitious marketing genius in many ways. But I think to some extent, based on the people that I spoke with, he's been a little bit overrated in the expansion, in that people that not enough of the story of the other contributors has been told, like Linda, for example, who, from all the people that were there in the office, said, you know, Linda was the one that was really had the razor sharp knowledge of the legal stuff and sort of all the details, that she was a huge part of. I mean, I was able to acquire a bunch of these office memos from the company that you can see day to day, Linda really managing things. And then, you know, Vince, I mean, I think Vince did know what he didn't know, in the sense that he would bring in people to fill those areas of expertise. Like, He knew he needed a Bob McMullen to straighten out the money. He knew he needed a Nelson Sveglar for the TV production, right? He brought him in to bring the TV up to a higher level of presentation. And so, he should be credited for surrounding himself with people that were really skilled at what they did, but he had a lot of help, I guess is what I'm saying.
And there was also like this, like Bob McMullen speaks about this, but you know, we've seen it with several figures, is that it almost feels like they do their time in the company. And then Vince gets to a point where it's, have I got any more use for this person? And then it's just like a swift exit for this person, no matter what the years are behind there. And then it's on to the next figures. And, you know, we've seen instances of loyalty with Vince McMahon, but at the same time, it's like just being there for a certain amount of time. It seems like Vince McMahon does have his shelf life with different people in these executive roles.
Yeah. And that was a recurring theme among both the wrestlers that I tracked down and the people we've been talking about in the office, that pretty much all of them said that there were many times where Vince did not follow through on what he said he was going to do. That, you know, you really couldn't take Vince's word for it. And pretty much all of them said that that was opposite his father, that Vince Sr., if he told you something, you could generally rely on it.
And Brad, there's a parts in this book where you mentioned you have internal documents. Is that something that one of the former executives gave you?
So some of it came from one of the former executives. Some of it came from lawsuit discovery I had to go to an actual physical file and everything digitized and make copies. So for those fans that really love, I mean, I love that stuff, right? I mean, I'm going to be putting a lot of that up on my website, thebradpack.com, where you'll have like, here's how much this house show grossed in 1987. Here's how much Bill Eadie got paid. You know, here's how much this pay-per-view, like these questions around, how much did these early pay-per-views gross? Well, we now have the actual WWF documents showing that stuff. And I think people could have a field day with going through then really poring over that stuff to see, you know, what all the information that's in there and cross-referencing that with what we've thought we've known about these things.
And there's even numbers for WrestleMania 3, the merchandise sold, how much they sold for programs. Mm-hmm. But any update on the attendance for WrestleMania 3?
That's the question. No, that all I have is the merchandise reports. I don't have, I think I probably have like pay-per-view gross, but not attendance. Yeah. It's still the mystery, I guess.
Well, I can promise there are people out there that are immediately bookmarking your site right now for these future documents that will be making their way up there. It's interesting. Like it almost turns into like several miniature books within the six pack. Like this alone, like the amount of research and knowledge into just the expansion period. I mean, at a point, are you looking at, man, this is almost its own book right here with the information and the sources that you're speaking to about such, I don't want to say underreported, but it's a period of the company. I think there's still so much out there that is unknown when it was a private company and some of these figures are no longer around anymore.
Right. I think with wrestling, we get into this state where we hear the same stories told over again. So we kind of assume it's true. It's like, oh, yeah, OK, we know that. Mm-hmm. But I think what I was able to do is show that, no, there's a lot that needs to still be fact checked. There's a lot that needs to be looked at. I kind of limited myself to, because really the story revolved around the Iron Sheik and Hulk Hogan. And therefore, I didn't go too much past like WrestleMania 1, right? And there, of course, there's so much more to be told there. But yeah, I think you could write a whole book about just the expansion. For me, the other part I wanted to mention, that the crazy, you know, a whole nother thread here, guys, is like the Middle East tour. I mean, you read that part.
Yeah.
I mean, the missing Middle East tours from 83, 84, 85, even after sitting down with Mike Breen, who was the referee that was in that crazy fight I wrote about with Jimmy Snuka, that was just, you know, just batshit crazy. Even after talking to Mike Breen and Jim Troy, who was like the guy who was the promoter, basically the guy in charge of the whole tour, and even looking at old documents, we still couldn't triangulate, okay, when did this tour exactly happen? Like, it's been almost completely lost to history. But what was crazy was that in that period, 83, 84, Vince, you know, he's sending his tapes over to the Middle East to be broadcast. And so he's having the guys that I interviewed translate like programs and documents into Arabic, because he has to get that over, you know, to the people in the Middle East, because he knows he's going to tour there. Then he starts setting up a tour in Africa, which has almost never been talked about. In 1984, he wanted to expand into Africa and have Tony Atlas go on that tour. They looked at doing New Zealand. So like, for all the stuff we talk about now with WWE going into, you know, United Kingdom and Saudi Arabia and Australia, like Vince was thinking that way really early on in a way that hasn't been reported on much. And I think it was largely because he needed that revenue so badly. I mean, that was a lot of, you know, you think about his costs when he's expanding and poaching all this talent. He needed a lot of cash flow, and touring places like, you know, Bahrain and Kuwait and Qatar, you know, was immediate cash flow. But then, as I report in the book, you get into some of these crazy stories where like Jim Troy is detained by the Kuwaitis for 2 months on that tour. I mean, again, there's so many.
Two months. Like, this is not like an overnight delay.
He missed his sister's wedding. I mean, there's this crazy stuff that was happening there that has not been told at all. And I know I read through all the observers from 1984. You know, Dave, and I think I asked Dave when I interviewed him, you know, he vaguely knew about those, but those tours were not reported in the Observer at the time. So, you know, there isn't much record at all of them.
It's maybe in the potpourri section. Jim Troy, by the way, was delayed for 2 months. What kind of ties into a lot of what we are talking present day about Vince McMahon. I mean, there were several paragraphs in here that stood out to me in the book, where you wrote, outside of Jim Troy and Mike Breen, loyalist to the end, every former office employee I interview expresses two things: immense respect for Vince's creative genius, work ethic, and success as a businessman, and serious misgivings about Vince the man and the workplace culture he created, with Ed Ricciuti stating, everything that human resources should have corrected existed at that place. But in 1983, human resources was not yet a thing. HR was simply Linda McMahon, the house mother of the fraternity. And I think that certainly rings true with a big spotlight on the culture of WWE that certainly did not, you know, advance, I would say, at the same level that the company's profile and revenues did.
Yeah, right. It just shows you how far back some of these, how systemic these issues are, right, with Vince at the helm.
I think it certainly does give you like an insight that I think you see to this day about Vince McMahon and look like these, like this, you know, complicated acceptance that those that were closest with him have had and now are coming to grips with when you're looking at some of, you know, the details of this Janelle Grant suit and people having to reckon with someone that they might hold in great respect, but on a level like just things that you cannot overlook.
Right. So Nelson Sweglar, the head of TV, just a very genteel guy, very, very well-spoken, soft-spoken, who worked for Vince for many years. And one of the things he shared with me was, you know, he was almost baffled by how mean Vince could be. He said, you know, just how cruel. Like, he has an example of being in these board meetings or production meetings, and he would just like dress down Howard Finkel, you know, like just like, what a dumb idea. How do you think about that? You know, and it's, you know, Nelson was not a guy that came from the wrestling world. He's a TV guy. I think he had an advanced degree in engineering or statistics, you know, just a very well-educated, urbane kind of guy. And he comes into this company, and I think he was always just sort of put off by some of that, you know, that aggressiveness that Vince had.
Did you get any sense of, go ahead, Brad.
No, you go.
Oh, did you get any sense of why there are these people who we know of in WF history who are just stay with the company for decades and decades, whether it's Howard Finkel or Harvey Whippleman, but then he did have these other people like Jim Troy and Ed Ricciuti, who, you know, who were with him very early on, but then he just sort of abruptly let go.
Well, I think my outside hypothesis on this is that after a certain period of time, you knew what you were getting with Vince. You knew that if you put loyalty above all else, and you were that loyal soldier, you could stay with the company a long time. But it was all about deference, you know, to the emperor, as they called him. And so, And I'm sure that Vince, you know, treated those people really well. I mean, there were, you know, Mike Breen, who was, did some merchandising and kind of started as a referee around when Tim White started, but was only with the company for a few years. You know, he said that, and I put this in the book, that Vince really took care of him. You know, Vince was very generous to him when he was trying to get a business loan for, I think it was the bar that he and, was it he and Tim White set up?
Yep.
You know, and Vin, you know, I put the story that Vince said, you know, he's like, well, Vince, you know, we need some money. And he's like, well, how much money do you need? And he's like, oh, we need a lot. He's like, well, how much? And I think he said it was like 30 grand or something. He's like, oh, that's not a lot of money. You know, $1 million is a lot of money. I mean, so Vince, you know, he could be very generous. I mean, Jose Luis Rivera, who I wrote about, probably had the most positive things of the wrestlers to say about Vince. And told me how one time Vince spotted him some money for his rent. But it's because Jose Luis Rivera was never a threat to Vince, right? He was an undercard guy. Like, you know, Vince was never, you know, if you challenge Vince like Bob Remus did, and I talk about that story of, you know, Bob going with his lawyer in 1984 to challenge Vince, which no one did in 1984. You know, that's
we're talking about Sergeant Slaughter.
Yeah, Sergeant Slaughter. That's part of why Sergeant Slaughter didn't last very long in the WWF.
Right.
So if you stood up to Vince, Bill Eadie, who I, you know, I talk about that lawsuit for 10 years that Bill refused. Bill said at some point it wasn't even about winning. It was about the principle, you know, of not giving in to Vince McMahon when he sued him in 1991 and ultimately settled, you know, for an amount that made him happy. You know, Bill was a guy that had been a psychology teacher and a high school teacher before he was a wrestler. And that's probably why he had something to fall back on. He was willing to stand up to Vince, and also probably why he was so good as the Matt Superstar, because he had literally taught psychology, right? He was, you know, he knew what he was doing.
And I suppose in contrast, to think of like the Harvey Whippleman's and the Howard Finkels, they may have been great guys and loyal, but they, you know, I don't think of them as executives.
Yeah, I met Howard at backstage at WrestleMania 20, and I was there in 2005 when he was the one that called the Iron Sheik to tell him he was going into the Hall of Fame. And so I could hear the conversation between Howard and Kaz. And my impression of Howard was he always was a bit markish, you know, like you could, you know, even, you know, here we are way off the record where he's calling the Iron Sheik. I'm in the Iron Sheik's living room, and he's sort of like, oh, Kaz, you know, you were great in Madison Square Garden in 1970. I mean, I think Howard really just loved the characters and he loved the boys. And so if you were willing to, you know, play that role, then you could stick around for a long time.
Final thing here is just, I mean, you sought out to speak to all these different individuals. And in the case of, you know, somebody like a Hulk Hogan, it's very hard to kind of break through. And I think he is someone that, you know, fact and fiction is just blurred altogether. But I think it's hearing from the people that were closest that maybe are not household names that provide some of the most interesting stories. I thought you did a great job of tracking down some of these people. Was that, I mean, for you just going into this project, was it almost more of a badge of honor to track down some of these lesser known names that had these great stories versus, you know, getting a sit down with a Vince McMahon or a Hulk Hogan, for instance?
Yeah. I mean, I think with someone like Hulk, Terry Bollea, it's like, how do you say something new, right? Because so much has been reported about him. So I really decided to take a very sideways approach to it. And yeah, let me try to find the guy he was in Ruckus with, the band, before he became a wrestler, right? Let me go find his childhood friends. Let me go find his childhood home and knock on the door, and ended up getting a tour of his actual home from the person that lived there. Finding people that knew him before he was Hulk Hogan, and some amazing stories coming out of that, like this guy, Danny Brower, who was Hulk's friend at a very young age in Port Tampa, who ended up being his like assistant on the road in 1989, who actually was carrying his steroids and, you know, played a role in all of that story. And then having him tell me this story about how he was suicidal and how Terry and Ed Leslie, Brutus Beefcake, kind of saved his life in 1980. And I mean, again, things that you would never hear unless you were able to actually find these guys and track them down.
you know, steroid handlers. I mean, not something you can just go up on Yelp and find a quality person to trust your gas with. But I definitely encourage everyone to check this out. I think you'll learn a ton about a lot of these figures and especially the expansion years. It's the six pack on the open road in search of WrestleMania. It's out next Tuesday through Hatchet Books, available on Amazon and bookstores near you. Support your local bookstores. And Brad, do you want to give a quick plug for the site as well and anything?
Yeah, like yeah. Thanks again. You guys do great work. Thanks for having me on. I'm at Brad Pack Books on Twitter and Instagram, and then the bradpack.com is where we'll have all those documents going up. So, you know, you only use 5% of the material you collect, so I want to be able to share some of that stuff.
Okay, yeah. Well, we'll be looking forward.
Highly anticipating the documents, yes.
Cool.
All the best with the book tour, Brad, and that. Thanks so much for taking some time to chat with us. We appreciate it.
All right, thanks, guys.
All right, Brad Baluchian joining us. David Bixenspan has that website on lock as we speak.
Yes, anyway. We will definitely, Bix and I will definitely be having a conversation when those documents become available, I'm sure.
Yeah, I would say, honestly, if you're someone that's just more interested in it, like, to hear from a Jim Troy, which, I mean, the extent of Jim Troy would probably be limited to Vince McMahon talking about him in Beyond the Mat, or at least alluding to him in Beyond the Mat. Like, these are figures that were, I'm always more interested in the people that were right next to power as opposed to the people that were the power that you're not always going to get the most straight answers with. Nor do I imagine Vince McMahon is doing much media these days. I thought Brad did a really good job of like just finding some of these people, like the main accountant for the WWF during the expansion years that, you know, you just would have to really go out of your way to track down and even know where to start to look for a Brad McMullen. Yeah.
It's all of the people that, you know, we've covered over the last several years, as far as like the George Berrios, but the, you know, the expansion era versions of those basically. And Linda McMahon is one as well.
Linda McMahon's another one. And I mean, I think she will be very prominently featured in the lead up. I believe there's an election this year, if I'm not mistaken. Is it an election year? 2024?
That's what I've heard. I've heard there's an election, and I've heard that Linda McMahon is on the board of the shell company, the SPAC that is acquiring a certain social media platform.
Did you happen to hear, one of Dana White's stories this week, for the guy that had said he's done with podcasts, he's now doing a lot of podcasts again. And one story he shared was being at a casino one night and drinking heavily. And the next day, the casino called him.
I think I've seen a video of this.
Yes. And
something different. Okay.
He thought he had gotten so inebriated that he had lost 80 grand gambling. And they called him saying, "Do you want us to hold this room for you at the casino that you had left last night?" And he basically made a comment to the effect of, "Yeah, don't get too comfortable with my 80,000 or something." And the guy on the line was like, "No, Dana, you gambled away $3 million last night." And that is how, and then they described his behavior to increase the limit and got very confrontational for the house to increase the limit. And yes, he just didn't recall. Like, he got so drunk that he forgot that he lost $3 million the next night, which is.
When was this?
He didn't give a timeline of when this was.
Yeah.
So, you know, relatable problems, I guess.
Yeah. I've not, the one time I went to Las Vegas, I did not gamble at all. And I definitely did not gamble away $3 million.
It's a good lesson to hold, but there you have it. Coming up tonight, we have a Dynamite in Quebec City as their Canadian run continues. About 4,100 tickets are out for that show. So that is coming up tonight. And then, yeah, we're into next week. We should note, Brandon and I are both heading down to Philadelphia for WrestleMania, but we will be here in our normal time slot next Wednesday, 3 Eastern, for Pollock and Thurston going into WrestleMania week. And figuring out what our WrestleMania schedule is going to look like. But I am going to both nights of WrestleMania, tentatively the ROH show on Friday night, and I'm going to the Mark Hitchcock Memorial show on Thursday night. Those are my shows that I currently have committed to.
Are there any other shows you're considering?
I don't know. It's the ones I'm most interested in. I'm either getting in too late on Thursday. I would have liked to have gone to Bloodsport, but that's not going to happen. I'm also going to miss Stardom because of my flight. And then, the rest, it all either conflicts with something that's going on. It's tough when you're going to shows that are going to be giant blocks of time. So I don't know how much more I'm going to get to.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm the same as you. I'm going to the Ring of Honor and then WrestleMania 1 and 2.
What is your prediction of what time night one of WrestleMania will end? It's a 7 p.m. Eastern start time.
Do we have for a the card, main though? Card.
We don't have the lineups for each night. I guess let's put it this way. Do you feel that it will be done by 11, which would give us a 4-hour window?
It's going to start at 7, right?
It's going to start at 7.
So maybe it'll end by 11. Maybe 11:30.
Okay.
And Collision is starting at what time? 11?
11:30. Well, it's when the game ends. They're hoping to be on at 11:30. So
okay. So it could be any time in that range.
Do you view that as this is going to be an awful night for Collision, or do you look at it as the basketball could give them like an artificial bump at the start of the show if they're immediately following it?
Well, we've had these before, like where Rampage did, you know, follow a big basketball game or something like that, and you'll see it'll be a higher rating than usual because the first several minutes of the first quarter or something like that will have this really pumped up viewership, and I expect it's just going to be the same. It'll be a really big quarter hour one, and then it'll be a steep decline from there, and it'll end up averaging a much higher audience than usual.
Well, we're going to find out what the appetite is for pro wrestling fans on that weekend, because there are going to be hours and hours of it.
It's a great experiment you could have is go to some bar where they're watching that game, and then after the game ends, and see how much people are still paying attention to the wrestling, and if they're, you know, discussing steel chairs and things like that, and memories of themselves being wrestling fans in a different era.
And if the patrons start screaming, put on the WWE press conference.
Yes.
Okay.
Hopefully they do that.
That is what Collision may be going up against. You can get a, you know, picture in picture, the press conference going head to head with Collision. So we'll probably be discussing more WrestleMania related business next week. So you can always check out Pollock and Thurston Wednesdays at 3 Eastern. Tonight, Way and I will be live minutes after Dynamite here on the Post Wrestling YouTube channel. And we're going to be doing our latest edition of Talk on Thursday at postwrestlingcafe.com. The title is as descriptive as we get about this show, where we just talk. And
we've been fact-checked here, by the way, that Iowa versus LSU would have to happen in the Elite Eight in the next round, so it cannot be finals. Thank you to Pete in Texas for correcting us on that.
I don't want to discourage our NCAA listeners that are out there that tune into this for the most comprehensive NCAA basketball breakdowns. Do you have a bracket this year?
No, no.
Nor do I. I used to get into March Madness, but long time ago. Could only focus on so many things. Maybe by next week, I will have my Ronda Rousey book report for us.
How much of it have you read so far?
I'm almost 100 pages in. I'm at the tail end of
it. How big is it?
270-ish.
Okay. And she's already written a book before this.
Yes. I read the first book, which was it was good. This one is I'm only in the MMA stuff. If you followed her MMA career, it's really fascinating. Like, this is the most she has talked about, just the depression she hit after the Holly Holm loss.
She would not do any media after she started losing. Right.
Yeah. So the last fight was Amanda Nunes, and famously in the lead up to that fight, like, she did nothing. She did not want to deal with the media. And I mean, you do get her perspective here of just how under the microscope she was and just hit this breaking point. And the media was one casualty of that she just wrote off all of the media as sort of being against her. It's really interesting just to kind of get into her mindset, whether you agree with it or not. Like, this was a woman that put ridiculous pressure on herself and basically said she could not say no to Dana White when he would come to her and say, hey, we need you to fight in 7 weeks. And she just was not going to turn down fights and put a ton of pressure on herself to stay undefeated. So when she finally lost, it was just, I think, broke her mentally with the sport. But yeah, I'm not even at the wrestling stuff yet, but I'm sure.
No WWE stuff yet.
No WWE stuff yet, but plenty of excerpts have made their way out there.
Yes.
So staff. There you have it, everyone. And of course, you can check out WrestleNomics every Sunday, 11 a.m. Eastern time. This has become my Sunday morning ritual. I have my coffee and I throw Brandon on. And it's like calm Sunday morning programming as my kids are trying to destroy our entire house. And I've got WrestleNomics in the background and a coffee. So there you have it.
It's usually family acceptable entertainment.
Yeah. PG, brother. You know, we don't get too much ranting and swearing by Brandon. Although I have learned, I have had WH Park in my car before with my kids, and I've had to censor as such. So there you have it, everyone. That concludes this week's edition. Thank you to CJ Donald for joining us, as well as Brad Baluchian as well. So you can check out his book, The Six Pack, that is out next week. And stay tuned for who will be joining us. Again, if you want to check out Brandon and I, our original reporting, go check out WrestleNomics.com, PostWrestling.com for our first look at WWE's consensual relationship policy, which was established in 2023. That is it for this week's show. We'll speak with you next week.